And without further ado, I'd like to jump into the symposium and introduce our first speaker, Lewis Rice. Lewis has over 25 years of experience as an active researcher in antimicrobial resistance and its clinical relevance. He is the chair of the Department of Medicine at the Alfred School of Medicine at Brown University, and we're very happy to have him. He is also the editor-in-chief of Antimicrobial Agents and Chemotherapy, the foremost journal on antimicrobial resistance in the world. And I'd like to thank him for speaking and invite him up.
Thank you, Kevin, and I want to thank Khalil for the invitation to speak here. It's really a pleasure to be here. It's not a conference that I attend, but it's certainly fascinating. So today what I'd like to talk about is does a strategy that uses two different antibiotics to try to forestall resistance in Neisseria gonorrhea make any sense, either from what we know about other organisms or what we know about the molecular biology? So I am a consultant for a few pharmaceutical companies and one diagnostic company. I will review the rationale for thinking combinations of antibiotics to prevent the emergence of resistance, discuss examples of species for which this will likely work or not, and discuss GC in the context of the above realities. So here are graphs that I'm sure are quite familiar to you, the history of antibiotics against gonorrhea early in the 1990s here. There was still some penicillin and spectinomycin use, and then ceftriaxone saw a major push here in the late 1980s until we had the era of oral therapy, which included oral cephalosporins and a number of fluoroquinolones. Well, unfortunately, the fluoroquinolone use was associated with a fair amount of resistance emerging in 2000, in the early 2000s, leading to its decline in fluoroquinolone use and a rise again of ceftriaxone, which is now the game because cefixime is falling out of favor in parts of the world because of resistance. In association with the reduction in the fluoroquinolone use, we have seen somewhat of a dip in resistance to fluoroquinolones, but not a tremendous dip. And what this graph shows very effectively is that the real, as big a problem as it is, there's a really major problem in the population of men who have sex with men. Just to add a finer point on it, this is just a combination of penicillin and tetracycline resistance, showing that a lot of strains that are inherently penicillin resistant are also resistant to tetracycline, and ones that are resistant to tetracycline also resistant to penicillin. So resistance does tend to gather and multiply in specific organisms. And then finally, since we've now moved on towards using cephalosporins as our primary therapy, it is no big surprise that we are now seeing a rise in not only cefixime resistant, but we are now seeing creeping up of the ceftriaxone MICs and even some very high-level resistant ceftriaxone strains. Again, the men who have sex with men population is having a bigger problem with this than other populations. And finally, or as I mentioned, high-level ceftriaxone and cefixime resistance. This is strain H041, isolated in Japan a couple of years ago with an MIC of 8 to cefixime and 4 to ceftriaxone. This is really quite high. And perhaps even a little bit more frightening, it's not just one bug that happened to do this. This is the penicillin binding protein, the mosaic penicillin binding protein found in H041 that was then transformed into a series of other strains that had other moderate levels of resistance, and in virtually all cases, substantial level of resistance is conferred simply by this penicillin binding protein, making it clear that a single transfer event can actually affect this resistance, and in one case actually more resistant than the clinical strain by twofold. So, with that background, in 2012, MMWR stated, based on experience with other microbes that have developed antimicrobial resistance rapidly, a theoretical basis exists for combination therapy using two antimicrobials with different mechanisms of action to improve treatment efficacy and potentially delay emergence and spread of resistance. I have therefore recommended a second antimicrobial, azithromycin or doxycycline, for use with ceftriaxone, with the rationale that this might forestall the emergence of resistance. So I think we have to ask ourselves, does that make any sense? Is it really a logical way of approaching this? So there is a history of combination therapy to prevent resistance, and we all know it very well. The early history of tuberculosis had wonderful successes using streptomycin. People who would have died left healthy but came back 3 months later, and they were now infected with just as many TB bugs, but they were resistant to streptomycin. And I correctly surmised that two drugs might forestall this, and in fact it did, because with all Mycobacterium tuberculosis is kind of a unique organism where all resistance has to do with mutations in chromosomal genes. And it is not a particularly social creature. It doesn't seem to share genes with too many other species. It's also worked to some degree in human immunodeficiency virus, and I suspect it probably will be shown to work in hepatitis C once we start treating more and more people with that. So there are examples of it. However, examples where combination therapy has not prevented the emergence of resistance, well, just about everywhere else that you've ever looked for it. So why might combination therapy not prevent resistance? In thinking about it, I think there are probably four major characteristics of organisms that might make combination therapy, if not preventative, maybe even more likely to cause resistance. One is the presence of transferable multi-resistance. The other is different pharmacokinetics between the two antibiotics. Three would be protective sites of infection and colonization. And four would be if they both have the potential to select the same resistance mechanism. So how does ceftriaxone and azithromycin and gonorrhea stack up in these four categories? Well, in terms of transferable multi-resistance, I think everybody here knows that Neisseria species are among the few that infect humans that are naturally transformable. They're able to take up DNA from other species and integrate it into their chromosome quite nicely. Pneumococcus is another organism, and as are some of the Viridan streptococci. So they can transfer DNA from one species to another. And this is nicely shown in most of the penicillin binding protein changes that we see in the highly resistant strains. This is just showing this would be an example of a sensitive gonorrhea penicillin binding protein. These are characteristic segments of Neisseria scenario or Perflava. And when you get the resistant Neisseria, you'll see that segments of these penicillin binding proteins have been integrated into the GC protein in order to create a mosaic protein. And so this is clearly an example of transferable resistance. Transferable resistance is also shown for resistance to azithromycin, and this has to do with alleles of the 23S RNA gene, and also can be conferred by mutations in the coding region or in the promoter region of the MTRR gene, which is a regulator of a pump that I will show you in a few minutes, pumps both of these antibiotics. In addition to that, there are plasmids. We know very well there are plasmids in Neisseria gonorrhea. The first wave of penicillin resistance was penicillinase producing gonorrhea. These encoded a TEM1 gene, which is a beta-lactamase gene common in E. coli and Klebsiella, and also common in gonorrhea. Now the resistance is more commonly due to the penicillin binding proteins, but this is just showing the plasmid is present both in meningococcus and gonococcus. And these plasmids can confer multiple resistance genes. Tetracycline can be on the same resistance, same plasmid as a penicillin as well. In addition, Marilyn Roberts' group back in the early 2000s showed by looking at Neisseria gonorrhea strains from a number of different decades that she was able to identify a number of different plasmid-mediated ERM genes that confer resistance to azithromycin and erythromycin. These are ribosomal methylases. They're transferable, and they're widely present in a number of different species, including gonorrhea, according to this. But most of the gonorrhea resistance to azithromycin at this point is due to mutations in the ribosomal proteins. Okay, so I think we can all agree that Neisseria is a highly social organism that is interested in taking up DNA that it needs. How about pharmacokinetics of ceftriaxone and azithromycin? Do they match up? Well, the azithromycin terminal half-life after a single dose is 68 hours. It's a very, very long half-life. It gets sucked up by the cells, and it keeps bouncing in and out of the cells for a long period of time, which is why we can give a five-day dose of Z-Pak, because levels last for 12 to 14 days. How about ceftriaxone? Well, it's 5.8 to 8.7 hours. So those don't match up. Ideally, if you want two drugs to prevent resistance to either one, they should have some kind of a matching pharmacokinetics. You don't want periods of time where there's not one drug present, but the other drug is. You'd like them both present. So, in general, what we're talking about here is pretty simple. Say there's two different resistance mechanisms, one in red, one in blue here. You give drug A in red, it eliminates all of the bugs that are not resistant to it, but regrowth leads to a resistant subpopulation. Similarly, if you give drug B in blue, it will eliminate all the organisms except the blue organisms, which will then regrow. And the magic of giving two drugs is that you eliminate all of them and there is no regrowth, so you don't have resistance. It makes some sense. It's all sort of based to some degree on a concept that's been floating around for the past 20 years called the mutant prevention concentration. This is basically the concept that if you have an organism that mutates to resistance and there's a certain amount of resistance you get out of a single point mutation, that if you always keep the level of the antibiotic above that MIC, you're not going to have the emergence of resistant mutants. But you have to do that throughout the dosing interval. Combination therapy is basically NPC therapy, only the second antibiotic is used to kill off the mutants resistant to the first. And what you're trying to do is keep things above this mutant selection window up here. Problems with the NPC is it's only relevant when resistance is incremental. The emergence of resistance often occurs away from the site of infection, so you don't know what your levels of antibiotic are, and there'll always be a washout period. The other thing is the MPC will vary with the baseline MIC. So when you see articles, they will tell you that, okay, the MIC here is 0.06. We have selected out for whatever mutations we can get. The most resistant mutation will take this MIC from 0.06 to 0.5 right here. And so, in fact, if you can keep the concentration at 1, you'll never see this organism. What it doesn't allow for is the multiple different types of small resistance mechanisms that might give you a slight increment in the MIC up to 0.12 or up to 0.25 and up to 0.5, which would still be in the susceptible range. However, now that same point mutation, which only would have gotten you up to 0.5, will get you from 0.5 to 4. Does this happen in reality? Well, if you look at distributions of MICs, these being to azithromycin and gonorrhea, you can see there's a whole distribution of MICs from 0.031 to 0.25 to 0.5, and these would be considered in the susceptible range, but probably have some modest resistance mechanisms at work, which will make the MPC even higher, often higher than the concentrations you'll be able to achieve. Are there protected sites of infection? Well, there sure are, I think. We know there's other sites of infection besides the urogenital tract, particularly the pharynx and the rectum. These are data just published this month showing that the proportion of extragenital gonorrhea and chlamydia infections associated with concurrent negative urethral tests is substantial. 73% for positive pharyngeal GC tests, 71.8% for positive rectal gonorrhea tests. A lot of people who are not having these sites tested have infection there. Do we really know that we're eliminating the colonization or infection in those sites? It's often asymptomatic. We don't know that. There are a lot of places where GC hangs out, and we can't be sure we're achieving the concentrations that we think we are. How about, do these both have the potential to select the same resistance? Well, here's a paper published, again, just recently, looking at the impact of this MTR-CDE pump that is present on the MIC of ceftriaxone and azithromycin. And the resistant strain, in this particular case, H041, has an MIC of 4 to ceftriaxone. If you knock out the pump, the MIC decreases fourfold. An MIC of 1 to azithromycin, if you knock out the pump, it goes down 16-fold. So in other words, this pump pumps both antibiotics. So exposure to either antibiotic is going to be a selective pressure to select out activation of this pump. So they're each going to be selecting resistance to each other. So the relevant comparisons really are, is this tuberculosis? TB has no plasmids, slow replication, restricted to a human host, no genetic exchange. Klebsiella pneumonia has plasmids. Klebsiella is a highly resistant organism, just as a model. Rapid replication, frequent genetic exchange through conjugation, multiple auxiliary mechanisms, and its ubiquitousy in the environment, which and colonizes as well as infects. What does gonorrhea resemble more, Klebsiella or tuberculosis? Well, I hope I've convinced you it's a little more like Klebsiella than it is like tuberculosis. And this is happening now. These are data from Canada just in the past couple of months, showing that there are now strains in Canada that have reduced susceptibility both to azithromycin and to gonorrhea, ceftriaxone. So what can we do about it? Well, the typical strategies we use are not to give antibiotics to people who don't need them. You have NAAT testing. That's very good. It's become the standard. It needs to be more timely. You need to really know exactly who you need to treat. That's one possible way. Don't give multiple antibiotics when one will suffice. I think you're in trouble here because you often need to treat two diseases, not only gonorrhea but chlamydia. And don't give antibiotics for any longer than is necessary. In the hospital, I think this is going to be our answer to resistance. But boy, you guys have already figured this out. You can't shorten it down from a single dose. So you really don't have an alternative there. There are additional problems controlling Neisseria gonorrhea antibiotic exposure is that asymptomatic colonization is common, and people receive antibiotics for a variety of reasons, including fluoroquinolones, which, by the way, are also pumped out by the MTRC-DE pump. So I think the alternatives are infection control. Boy, that's a bear with sexually transmitted diseases. Has obvious limitations. We can hope for a vaccine. There's a lot of people working on it. And new antibiotics. Well, pharma's getting out of antibiotics. And in fact, treatment of GC has never been used as an example or as a study to license a new antibiotic. I know there are some companies that are interested in thinking about that, but it's still kind of a long way off. So there's not a lot of hope out there on the horizon at the moment. So, in conclusion, I think there are growing issues of resistance and gonorrhea to both ceftriaxone and azithromycin. Given what we know about the microbiologic characteristics of the species, combination therapy is unlikely to forestall resistance and may, in fact, actually promote it. And new agents to treat gonorrhea or vaccines to prevent it are urgently needed. Thank you for your attention.